From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Out of Egypt, Andre Aciman's personal version of the Exodus story. He grew up in Alexandria in a Jewish family, but as anti-Semitism rose in Egypt, his family was forced out. He has a new book about his life in exile. Also, comic Margaret Cho on her misadventures starring in the first network sitcom about an Asian American family. It was the focus of her one-woman show, which has been adapted into a new film. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new supernatural thriller, What Lies Beneath. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. 11 days now of tough negotiations at Camp David as Israeli and Palestinian negotiators continue to struggle with the tough issues still keeping them from a peace treaty. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the negotiators have been working hard.
The parties are making serious efforts to deal with the issues. Serious efforts are underway by the negotiators, led by their leadership, to try to deal with these issues. But nonetheless, it remains very hard going.
He says the negotiators plan to take a break tonight for a pickup basketball game with both teams, including Americans, Palestinians, and Israelis. The Defense Department says the policy on gays in the military is working, but there needs to be more training to eliminate anti-gay behavior, like the abuse that led to the beating death of a soldier at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, last year. Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki says the incident at Fort Campbell was an isolated one.
During the course of that five-month investigation, the Inspector General surveyed or interviewed over 2,000 people from Fort Campbell. Overall, the investigation concluded that the chain of command responded appropriately to matters with respect to enforcement of the policy, and that the command climate at Fort Campbell before 5 July 1999 was a positive environment.
Nevertheless, the Defense Department has unveiled a new plan requiring military commanders to take action against anyone who engages in, condones, or ignores anti-gay behavior. It's an effort to eliminate harassment of gays in the military. Federal authorities in Charlotte, North Carolina, have arrested 18 people for allegedly smuggling cigarettes to support the Lebanese group Hezbollah. From member station WFAE, Amy Quinton reports.
More than 200 local, state, and federal law enforcement officials conducted raids of 18 businesses and residences throughout the Charlotte region. The raids came as a result of a three-and-a-half-year investigation authorities dubbed Operation Smokescreen. Charges against the individuals include money laundering, immigration and naturalization violations, and conspiracy to traffic contraband cigarettes. But court documents show links to Hezbollah, U.S. Attorney Mark Calloway.
The affidavit supports search warrants that authorize, among other things, the searching of certain locations for evidence of material support of a designated foreign terrorist organization, in this case, Hezbollah.
Calloway says there could be further charges. For NPR News, I'm Amy Quinton in Charlotte.
Republican presidential hopeful George W. Bush says he'll make up his mind about a running mate this weekend. A number of House Republicans have been pressuring him to choose Arizona Senator John McCain, even though McCain has repeatedly said he's not interested. Aides say Bush could announce his choice as early as Monday. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington. Leaders of the group of eight nations attending their annual summit expressed concern about rising oil prices today. They called for greater stability of oil markets to ensure sustained economic growth. They also saluted President Clinton, who was attending his final meeting of the group. More crews are being brought in to fight a fast-growing fire in southwest Colorado. It's burned 1,500 acres since it started Thursday in Mesa Verde National Park. Dan Dreyer of Colorado Public Radio reports.
What started out as a 50-acre fire on Thursday night has blown up into a major problem for hundreds of firefighters. Strong wind and very dry conditions have fueled the fire, similar conditions that helped fan two costly blazes in eastern Colorado earlier this summer. So far, there have been no injuries. Tourists were evacuated late Thursday. Mesa Verde is known for its ancient Anasazi Indian cliff dwellings and other archaeological sites. So far, none of the cliff dwellings is threatened. Firefighters don't know what started the fire, but they suspect that lightning could be to blame. They can't say when they expect to have the fire under control. For NPR News, I'm Dan Dreher in Denver.
A jury in Las Vegas has recommended that a former Marine be sentenced to death in connection with the killing of four supermarket employees in June of 1999. The same jury had found 24-year-old Zane Floyd guilty of the murders. It took them less than two full days to decide his fate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 110 points today. The Nasdaq Composite was down 90 points, and the S&P 500 was down 15 points. Trading was moderate. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Alltel at alltel.com, one company offering multiple telecommunications services.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, False Papers, Andre Aciman writes about his life in exile. It's a sequel of sorts to his memoir, Out of Egypt, which was his personal version of the Exodus story. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded in 1995 after the publication of Out of Egypt. Aciman grew up Jewish in Egypt. His great uncle moved the family there from Turkey in 1905. The family settled in Alexandria, which was a lively international city with people of many cultures living together. But the Jews of Egypt faced growing anti-Semitism after 1956. That was the year that Egyptian President Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, and Israel, France, and England invaded Egypt to regain access to the canal. Over the next few years, Aciman watched other Jewish families get expelled from Egypt. His father, a prosperous businessman, was forced out in 1964 when Aciman was 14. I asked him what it was like to be Jewish in Egypt when he was young.
There were many kinds of Jews in Egypt. You had those who practiced, and then you had those who didn't practice. I was brought up in a family that did not practice. I was not bar mitzvahed. I did not know how to read Hebrew. A lot of my friends did. Initially, it was, I think, a very nice lifestyle for the Jews. They were totally tolerated, assimilated. Even the religious ones were totally assimilated. And they went about their business and lived very happily. Eventually, it became increasingly difficult. There had been some incidents even before 1948. In 1954, there had been a spy ring that was broken up, and a big scandal ensued. And after 1956, the Suez War, things became increasingly difficult.
When you were growing up, there were no movies allowed with Jewish actors or Jewish themes. So what are some of the movies you missed because of that?
Oh, we missed Ben-Hur. We missed Cleopatra. Many movies with Paul Newman never came because it was said he was Jewish. And as I say in the book, the irony is that Kirk Douglas movies always were shown because he was so prototypically American, or fitted the image of what every Egyptian thought an American was like. So they never knew he was Jewish, so we saw his movies. And so, of course, the way they reached their decisions was totally capricious. They thought that Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was fine. It never bothered them. But they would sometimes confuse it with Golda Meir. So, and that occasioned some problems as well. But, you know, there were things that they thought they could determine which were wrong. But you were living in this crazy, totally crazy climate.
In 1956, during the Suez War, Israeli forces, French and British forces, attacked Egypt. How did that change your status as Jews in Egypt?
It changed it radically, overnight almost. Ever since 1948, the Egyptian forces had, you know, been defeated by the Israelis. And there had been some resentment and ongoing resentment, but after 1956, the fundamental confusion was finally put in effect. That is, you confuse a Jew with an Israeli. The supposition being that if you're Jewish, you're going to be pro-Israeli, and therefore you're suspect. Or maybe you're the easiest scapegoat or the easiest person to punish. The Jews were as punished as much as the British and the French after 1956. Many Jews and many French and British were kicked out summarily with all their possessions confiscated.
Which side did you want to win in 1956?
Oh, I was too young. I enjoyed the war. I think I made that obvious in the book. because it gave, as far as I was concerned, from this child's perspective, it was like an ongoing party that lasted almost a month. There were a lot of people in the house, and we were all sleeping on mattresses. So I was playing with my cousins all the time. It was like a big birthday party. When the lights went out, because you had to, you know, there was a blackout, it was always wonderful to just be sitting together with about 30 people and just wait for the lights to come back on. And it was very warm.
Which side did your parents want to win?
Undecided. I think they probably wanted the British to win because they wanted things to become as they had always been. And there had already been a change since the king had been deposed. So they wanted the Western colonial powers to reassert themselves in Egypt. Therefore, life would be much more comfortable for them. And they expected that to happen overnight. After all, who would have foreseen that the Egyptian forces, which did lose the war, but, you know, eventually there were other forces that became involved, who would have expected that the British and the French would immediately stop attacking Egypt and retract, or sort of recoil, or whatever?
After the Suez War in 1956, friends of the family, relations also, started to leave because they were expelled for being French, for being Jewish. Why didn't your family make a move sooner to leave? Didn't they sense that the climate was definitely turning against them?
Yes, they knew that, we did know that our days were numbered. In our case, the days numbered almost 10 years. Why did we not move? And I think you should ask that question to many other groups that stay put because they're caught in a sort of totally historically paradoxical situation. On one hand, my father was doing very well. On the other hand, he didn't want to go and explore similar business ventures in Europe. He was afraid of Europe. He was comfortable in Egypt. He didn't want to go to America. He didn't want to find out how much of a businessman he was, really, vis-a-vis the big business concerns abroad. Doing well in Egypt, however, puts you in a paradoxical situation. If you're doing well and you leave, that meant that you had already tucked away money abroad, and that was against the law. So you're there. You wait until they take everything away from you so that you can leave. On the other hand, you don't want them to take everything away from you because that makes you poor. So there we were trapped, as it were.
So was your family officially expelled?
Yes. We got it by... they call you and they tell you, look, you have to leave. You think it's a crank call, and eventually becomes gradually confirmed to you that, in fact, it wasn't a crank call.
You describe what the crank call... You got a series of calls that you weren't sure whether they were crank calls or actually the police.
Right.
What did the caller say?
Oh, he would... Sometimes if I picked up, he would say obscenities. And I had no idea what he was talking about because I was 13 or 14. And though I knew a few things, you know, certain other things I had no idea existed. So there were real obscenities that when I told him to my father, he would be outraged. But there was that, and then they were saying things like, what did you do today? Why did you go to this restaurant? Silly questions that just made it clear to you that you were being constantly watched.
How did your father tell you that it was time to go?
Well, he sat me down one day when I came back from school, and he said it in English, ironically. We never spoke English. He says, they want us to go. So I thought he meant... they want us to go somewhere or whatever. And he said, no, they want us to go almost sort of in the intransitive. They want us to go away. At which point it suddenly dawned on me that we were being kicked out of Egypt. And I didn't think it was so bad. I mean, I was excited to leave on one hand. On the other hand, I wasn't at all.
Your father asked you to do a lot of... work to help the family pack and get ready. Which were the tasks that you were assigned?
I didn't have to pack. He was always afraid of being arrested at the last minute. So one of the things he had me do was take down telephone numbers in a little agenda that I had. And these were telephone numbers abroad in France and England and Italy. And I was, as if I got there and he was arrested in Egypt, I would have to call these people and they would sort of call government people in their respective countries and they might release him from the Egyptian hands. But it was things of that nature. I was in charge of buying the ticket to go to Italy because he thought that That very same day, he was going to be arrested. Then I was in charge of selling the ticket when it became obvious that we might not be asked to leave after all. And it's a good thing that nobody wanted to buy the ticket, because it turned out that that same afternoon, we were in fact told that we were going to have to leave, and that this retraction had been almost fictitious and perverse. So I was in charge of these little minor details, mailing or sending telegrams to all my uncles abroad, telling them we were arriving. That was my job.
Was it good for you to have such important jobs to do?
Oh, loved it. I enjoyed it. It made me feel very much like a, you know, like one of those characters in the movies who does all these almost spy things, making sure that the family can stay afloat if the man of the family is taken in prison. It made me feel very important. I was not a kid anymore. And one of the things I like to show in the book is how, when my father told me, please take care of these matters for me, I'm going to be put in jail tonight. Running these errands for him in the city, and suddenly I hear somebody calling me, and it's my dad saying, "Hey, Andre." And I turn around and it's him, and he says, "Look, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm running these errands for you." And I'm almost disappointed. And I say, weren't you supposed to be in jail? He says, "Oh, no, not at all. That was all nonsense." At which point, we go and have coffee together.
My guest is Andre Assaman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Andre Assaman, recorded after the publication of his memoir, Out of Egypt, about growing up Jewish in Egypt and being forced to flee in 1964 because of anti-Semitism. He has a new collection of essays about his life in exile called False Papers. The night before you left Egypt, the family had a Seder.
Right.
Was it a night of Passover?
It was the first night of Passover. My aunt, Elsa, was the one who insisted on Passover. She was the one who wanted ceremonies. We were living now in her house. She was officially in charge of that house.
We should explain here that Passover is the holiday that celebrates the end of the Jews' bondage in Egypt, and you've called your memoir Out of Egypt, which is very kind of resonant with that. So here you are having a Seder, celebrating the end of bondage in Egypt, just as you're getting ready to leave the country, and you decide that you don't want to participate in the Seder. You don't want to read the prayers. You don't want to have anything to do with it. Why didn't you?
Well, A, because the most obvious answer is that I had to submit to her will and celebrate something that was religious and I didn't want to. But I think I was old enough to realize that the total absurdity, almost farcical nature of this. Here we are, Jews who are in Egypt and celebrating Passover, meaning that they left Egypt. So it's one of those repeat performances that I think it's Marx alleging Hegel said the first time things happen in history, it's tragic, the second time it's farcical. This was very, very farcical, in the sense that, we were celebrating something that had no meaning. We were not even supposed to be in Egypt anymore as Jews. But there we were. And I didn't really want to go ahead with this entire motion, which had no meaning. As far as I was concerned, I wanted to stay in Egypt. I didn't want to leave. And I wasn't going to celebrate the leaving of from Egypt. Certainly not on that night where I was supposed to. And certainly not on that particular night in history, which was our last night in Egypt. I wanted to stay.
How did the family decide where to move?
That decision was almost made for us. Who was the closest relative? The closest relative was in Italy. We had reacquired Italian passports. We had to stop in Italy. Somebody had managed to arrange some kind of apartment, makeshift and temporary apartment for us in Italy, so we went to Italy. It was very difficult. We spent 3 years in Italy, totally out of sorts, because we weren't used to Italy, weren't used to life in Europe. We couldn't quite adjust to the fact that we had become not just poor, but extremely poor.
Your great-grandmother used to say, Jews lose everything twice in a lifetime. When your family lost everything in Egypt, did your great-grandmother's words take on new meaning for you?
Actually, it was my Aunt Elsa who says, you know, you lose them at least twice. She had lost everything in Germany before coming during the war to Egypt to her brother who had made a fortune. Yes, and I mean, I put those words there knowing exactly what the kind of reverberation they would have, because you don't only lose things once, you lose them twice or at least twice, which means that you have to play out this kind of exile many, many times, not just in the history of a people, but in the history of one generation. And one of the things I wanted to make sure that people saw in my book was the notion that exile is something that is intimate to Jewish history, or at least the awareness of what might be called Jewish history, that you play out exile many, many times. It is part of you, and when it happens, it's not something that's sudden or unexpected. It's something that has been inscribed there and embedded there, and it's finally manifesting itself like a bad gene that you were expecting would show up. So nobody's surprised. You're just sorry that it happened at that point in your life.
You're a writer, and you teach literature. You work with language. Your mother was deaf.
That's right.
And her speech was very hard for most people to decipher. And so I'm wondering how much language you learned from her.
That's a very, very troubling moment. It's an enduring problem that I have. When people ask me what is the language that I feel most comfortable with, sometimes I will say English, sometimes I'll say French, even sometimes Italian. But I know that in the back of my mind, I'm fundamentally, and I realize that this sounds very ironic, I'm fundamentally a nonverbal person. I've lived most of my childhood with my mother, though everybody was, of course, dying to take me away from her and give me the right influence, the right speech, the right everything, which is why I'm so aware of how people speak and the problem that it played in my life, good manners, good speech, etc. My mother is fundamentally a person who speaks in very few words. She speaks a lot, but she speaks in very few words, and she communicates the most meaningful emotions by not necessarily saying words. They may be just the equivalent of sort of clicks and grunts and sort of vowel sounds and so on. And these are the things that I normally expect from her when she wants to tell me that she loves me. She won't say, I love you, the way we've problematized these three words in our society. She will just say something that is a sound and that's it. And good enough, and it means everything. And that's the kind of language I grew up with. I grew up with an entourage of people who were deaf. And they were deaf and mute, or deaf and dumb, whatever you want to call them. They were people who didn't speak. And they didn't even gesticulate very correctly, because many of them signed poorly. So that they really relied on gut feeling and gut interaction. It doesn't mean that they didn't talk much. They were constantly communicating. But it was nonverbally, and I grew up with that. So even here I am in an interview, I have this sense that I have to watch myself, because I might suddenly lapse into this nonverbal dimension.
Does that actually happen to you much?
No, it never happens. But when I write, and writers, you know, always make a point of saying that writing is the thing that is the most meaningful to them. When I write, I'm always aware that I'm almost putting on an act. I'm not supposed to be verbal in the first place. So what am I doing writing these sentences? Which is probably, Nietzsche says something very nice, that certain writers are always dulling their tracks on the sand to avoid giving the reader any clue of what they were really thinking of when they wrote the sentence initially. And I always have that feeling when I'm writing that I'm constantly sort of buffing or scumbling my original tracks, because these were the gut language that they were written in.
There's a moment in your memoir where you're with your mother in the grocery and there's a blackout, mm-hmm. and you know that, you know, planes will be coming soon. And you're on the phone, I think, with your family, and your mother's saying, tell them there's a blancor.
Yes.
And you say, there's a blancor. And the person you're speaking to says, there's a what? And you finally all figure out that your mother meant to say there's a blackout, but she can't really say blackout. And you're young and you don't know the difference, so you're saying blankoa. Did that happen to you a lot, that you learned language from your mother and the language you were learning happened to be words that didn't really exist?
Well, it was corrupt language, yes, and it was happening constantly. And, of course, they would finally understand what I was trying to say, and they would always say something like, oh, the poor child, you know, growing up with this mother who can't even say this. And which didn't at all bother me, because I realized that my mother's speech was faulty, but I never knew when she was saying something that it was faulty if I didn't know the word in the first place. So I would repeat it, and I was corrected. And that, you know, that always reminds me of this. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned this nonverbal dimension in me, that, you know, I'll say things, and I'm always expecting somebody's going to call and say, what on earth were you writing about? This is absolutely sort of trivial, or it's drivel, and how could you say this? I'm sorry, I guess I must have lapsed in my mother's language. So it's still going on, and my attitude, when that's why I'm a very easy writer to work with, because when an editor sort of chastises me or tells me this is wrong, I will immediately say, yes, of course, you're right, because this is not my language.
Well, how did you develop such a love of language if you were so uncomfortable with it?
That what they say about Demosthenes, you know, he was a stutterer, and he was a bad spokesman, or a bad had the speech defect or impediment, and therefore he had to overcome that. And one of the things that probably, because I don't know, is probably what I've tried to do is overcome this as best as I could by writing in a manner that would conceal as best as possible the fact that I have difficulties with language.
Yet, you know, you speak several languages. You speak French. Mm-hmm. You speak English. What else do you speak?
I speak Italian. I used to speak Arabic. I had Greek at some point. But, you know, I speak every language with an accent, and it's the wrong accent. So, if you ask me which is my real language, I wouldn't know what to say.
What would you guess?
I would have to say, well, it depends for what. If it's for scholarly situations, probably English. If it's to speak very dearly to someone, might be French. If I want to gossip, probably Italian. If I want to really, really say things that are from the heart and the soul and all that, well, my mother's language.
Andre Aciman recorded in 1995 after the publication of his memoir, Out of Egypt. He has a new collection of essays about his life in exile called False Papers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comic Margaret Cho on her journey to hell and back, hell being her experience of starring in a TV show, the first network sitcom about an Asian-American family. There's a new film version of her one-woman show. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews What Lies Beneath, starring Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of comics hope to get their own sitcom and, like Jerry Seinfeld, emerge rich and famous. When comic Margaret Cho got her own sitcom, it was a nightmare. Her ABC series, All-American Girl, which aired in the 1994-95 season, was the first network sitcom about an Asian-American family. Her sitcom experience and its aftermath became fodder for her one-woman show, I'm the One That I Want. A film version of that show has just been released. It's already opened in San Francisco and Seattle and will open in other cities over the next few weeks. In the show, Cho describes how she was advised by people at the network to lose weight before shooting the series and how she followed through with an extreme diet that landed her in the hospital. Here's Cho on stage talking about publicizing her sitcom at a press conference where she and her producers were questioned by reporters.
I stood in front of 101 television critics for a big critics convention, and Gail was on one side, Gary was on the other side. And the critic asked me, he said, "Miss Cho, isn't it true that the network asked you to lose weight to play the part of yourself on your own TV show?" And Gail grabbed the mic for me and said, "There is no truth in that whatsoever." I was losing it. I was starving myself to death, and yet I would read in tabloids, "Margaret Cho has thunder thighs," or "the chow-like Cho diet." They printed this fake diet that I never went on, with fake quotes from me like, "When I was young, I was raised on rice and fish." I go back to that natural Asian way of eating. You can almost hear the mandolin in the background. "When I was a little girl, I grew up on the rice paddy. And we don't have any food. But even though we have no food, I have a tendency to put on weight."
Margaret Cho, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I want to hear more about how you were forced to go on this diet when you had your TV show. How and why did they approach you on this?
Well, it was very sort of sensitively handled. The producer of the show called me up and tried to break it to me as delicately as possible. I think she was chosen to do the job because she was my friend, and I probably would have accepted things from her that I may not have accepted from a man, but I don't know. And I wasn't exactly forced into it. It was just put to me, suggested as delicately as possible, which I think is just the same as forcing somebody to do it, especially because women are so held up to this ridiculous ideal that we should be thin and kind of perfect looking. And I fell very much into that trap. And I was very young and very impressionable. And I think it's so taboo in our society to ask somebody to lose weight. But when somebody actually asks you, then I think that you really do feel forced, even though it wasn't really, you know, against my will. I did it, but it certainly was very terrifying, and I lost an incredible amount of weight because it was so terrifying. I'm sure that fear was definitely a factor in there, and I talk about it a little in the show that it was diet and exercise and sheer terror
so
that the weight came off.
When they asked you to lose weight, the show hadn't started yet, right?
The show hadn't started yet. We actually hadn't even shot the pilot. That it was in order to shoot the pilot where I was asked. And it was interesting because it had never been discussed at all before in the development process, in any of the negotiations, in any of the script meetings, in anything. It had never been brought up. And even before that, my weight had never been an issue in my work. I had never had a problem with it, and I didn't know how to deal with it. If I had had the presence of mind to say no, if I had had some self-confidence, if I had had a little bit more love and care for myself, I would have refused. I did not have that at that time.
But it's awkward, you know. Here, these are the professionals. These are the people in the business who know television. And
yes.
They're supposed to be giving you advice, and they're telling you, hey, you're too chubby. So, you know, you're in the position where you're supposed to be deferring to their wisdom.
Exactly. And I thought that this was Hollywood. This is how it goes. And
it is how it goes.
And it is how it goes. You know, and I'm not an unusual case. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
It happens every day. But I was not... I was not hired for that.
Didn't you feel like, hey, didn't you guys notice this before?
Well, it had never been brought up. It had never, ever been brought up. I think that suddenly they saw that I could be more than just a comedian. Instead, I could be an ingenue. It would be better for me to be an ingenue. And that's what they had decided somewhere through it all when I had been hired for my comedic talent, not for my looks. Although I... was always insecure about my looks anyway. So I believed it and I didn't question them.
So you lost 30 pounds in 1 week, I believe, and then ended up in the hospital?
In 2 weeks, and I was hospitalized. And, you know, it's really sad. It's really sick that I did that to myself. And yet I don't blame anybody. It just happened. And it certainly makes for good comedy later. All my
yes, it does.
Adventures,
I'll vouch for that.
I think it's okay now.
So what did you do to lose weight that quickly?
I went into this ridiculous diet and exercise regime that was far too intense for me, which is why I was eventually hospitalized. And you know, after that, I kind of couldn't really work out too much, so I started taking diet pills, which made my health and my sanity just was worse. And it was really difficult to cope with all the pressures on the set, and taking the pills set a dangerous precedent later, you know, for this drug use that would not cease for many years after.
Oh, so do you think the diet pills led you into...
I think the diet pills... I mean, I had always had been predisposed to that kind of lifestyle, but that really... that was a dangerous introduction and into something else, something higher.
So let's talk a little bit about the show. You had the network sitcom, All American Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like the show? It was built around you.
It was built around me,
yeah.
But I did not like the show. I had no... real creative control over it. I really let it get away from me, and it was very difficult. It was a difficult process for me because I was so incredibly insecure, and already my attention had been diverted into this idea of, oh, I have to lose weight and put all of my energies into that. And so I had very little left over to be funny. I just really had a hard time fitting into the family hour of television. My act was always way too blue, way too raw and edgy for that audience. And yet here I was presented for that audience. And you know, there was kids on the show, and I didn't understand that. And it really was, my image was taken and distorted and you know, completely got so far away from who I was. And I talk about it in the show where I... was so unrecognizable to myself, all I know is that I had failed, but I had failed as somebody else, which was an incredibly painful experience.
The premise of the show was, you know, you played a Korean-American young woman named Margaret Kim,
mm-hmm.
and the show focused on generational conflicts between you and your parents.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the real truth of it is that it was perceived as a cultural conflict, you know, like, oh, you know, I think that people saw my comedy, these network executives saw my comedy and said, oh, well, it's about the struggle between East and West. And actually, the real struggle is what I'm saying in my stand-up is my parents are a pain in my ass, and they're not really, it's not cultural. They're just a pain in the ass. And that's what I think that was misunderstood somehow.
Maybe you could choose an episode from the show that was actually based on something that happened in your life and compare how it happened in your life with how it was written for the show.
Well, There is something that I do in my stand-up act where my parents own a bookstore, and it was in San Francisco, and it was in the 70s, and it was in a gay area. And my mother had the very interesting job of stalking the gay porn section. And so I talk about it in my act. It's a routine that I do, and it was taken from my stand-up and then put into the television show. Like, my parents had a video store, and I was threatening my mother that I was going to wear an outfit that one of the porn actresses was wearing. So that's sort of how it was interpreted for the show, is that it wasn't – what I was talking about was the juxtaposition of this older Korean woman kind of dealing with the idea of gay pornography, and it was that there was humor there for my audience, and then it was taken and kind of distorted into this idea that my mother was disapproving of me because I was rebelling and threatening to be like a porn actress. So I guess that's not the best, but that's the closest example that I could think of how it was all misinterpreted.
My guest is comic and actress Margaret Cho. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1999 interview with comic and actress Margaret Cho.
You do very funny impersonations of your mother in your performances. When did your parents come to the United States from Korea?
1964.
Now, you said your parents owned a bookstore.
Yes, in San Francisco, called Paperback Traffic, in the 70s and the 80s.
What kind of books did they sell in addition to the gay pornography?
Well, it was really a very eclectic bookstore. They sold a lot of books on art. It catered to this the gay community, more or less, you know, and they had a lot of books on art and photography and film and an extensive section on and metaphysical studies and social studies, and it was one of those, you know, just It was a really great family bookstore, and there were a lot of employees that were gay and lesbian, and my father really kind of thrust me into the care of them, and saying that, you know, they would be able to educate me in a way that he couldn't, and that I should be exposed to their culture because they will teach me about art and they will teach me about the things in the world that I need to know about. And even though he was incredibly conservative in many ways, that was the greatest way to grow up with a wonderful group of gay nannies. And it's odd. They were a very interesting bunch of guys and girls, and it was a great way to, like, be a kid.
Now, in addition to running the bookstore, I know your father also wrote joke books?
He wrote one joke book, and which was a kind of a reference book for speakers to, you know, like Toastmasters quotations or jokes for speech making, or I don't really know. I can't read it. It's in Korean, so I don't read Korean.
So is he a bit of a jokester himself?
Well, I guess so. I think he's more of a scholar, but he's not really that. He's not really cut up. I suppose it's more of a literary thing.
Did he take an interest in jokes when you were young? Did
No, but when I was young, I used to watch this show called Comedy Tonight with my father, and it was stand-up comedians, and, you know, there were a lot of people on that show, like Whoopi Goldberg and Bobcat Goldthwait and all these different comedians, and it was a local show. It was, like, San Francisco, and it was just all these different people, and my father and I would watch it Thursday night at 9 o'clock, and we would laugh, and he would laugh, and my father loved stand-up comedy, And we would also watch Richard Pryor movies together. Even though I was so young, and I didn't really understand what was happening, you know, and all the sexual material and everything was lost on me, yet it was so delightful to see my father laughing. My father, this incredibly serious, incredibly dour, stoic man, laughing. And I thought, oh, well, this would be ultimately a way to please him if I go into stand-up comedy, which really wasn't the case. He was very angry at me for years for embarking on that career. But I think early on, I kind of thought, oh, stand-up comedy is something that my father likes, and, you know, I can do that.
Why was he angry with you for becoming a comic?
Well, he just did not believe that it was possible for me to have a career. My parents, both of them, did not want me to do stand-up comedy. They didn't want me to go into acting. They didn't want me to go into anything that they did not just, they were not able to kind of see the outcome in. They just did not think it was possible. You know, they experienced such intense racism and hatred and difficulty just surviving as Americans in the 60s and 70s. And so they just could not believe that this country would accept their child in that way.
Can you give us a sense of what your act was like when you were a teenager and just getting started?
Well, it was pretty much the same thing. You know, I was just talking about my family and talking about my relationships and how hideous they all are. And that's all I've ever done. You know, just talking about my life.
What would you say about your mother then?
When I talk about her, I don't really judge her or say anything about her. I just say what she says.
Right.
You know, I'm just repeating what she says. And to me, the voice of my mother in my act really is the voice of my Asianness. The fact that I am very, a very modern person, I'm very independent, and yet there is a part of me that is ancient and as old as the culture, and I cannot let go of. I cannot let go of the color of my skin, and I cannot let go of these things that will always be there. And so I cannot let go of this voice that is always going to be there.
Could you do your mother's voice for us?
Oh, yes. Well, she, whenever I talk to her lately, she's very, "Mommy is so famous because you always do mommy, and mommy is so famous. I play golf and everybody know who mommy is." And it's true. They all know.
How does your mother feel about you doing her on stage?
Well, she loves it, yet my parents have never come to see me perform. I think that what I do terrifies them. I think that they cannot bear it in a way. That they are so proud and so excited for me and always watch me on television and always there showing their friends videotapes and playing my records and being there for me, but they cannot come see me because I think they just are so afraid. And I don't invite them because I'm terrified as well. I don't know if I'd be able to do it if they were there or I don't know.
What are they afraid of?
I'm not sure. I think that what I do also is so culturally... It's just this very outlaw thing, you know, to discuss your feelings and intimacies and failures and pain so openly and so loudly and to do so all these things and get laughter and on top of it all be a woman is so outrageous that I think that it's hard for them to really enjoy what I do, but they have to.
We talked a little bit about the show, the sitcom that you used to have, All American Girl, and the conflicts between your character in that show and her parents. Have you had a lot of kind of cultural conflicts with your parents over the years?
No. Well, you know, what was lucky for me was that I was expelled from high school when I was 15 years old. And so I disappointed my parents so young that they learned not to expect anything from me. And that gave me the freedom to really have the best life because I know so many people that are my age and my generation who are Koreans and are just paralyzed by parental control. They cannot break free from the expectations and the needs and desires and wants of their parents to go into certain careers that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily pursue, but only do so to keep their parents happy. And because I was so assured not to get parental approval so young, that I had this incredibly free ride. Like, I could just go and pick and choose whatever I wanted to do, because I didn't have to worry about what they were thinking and what they were going to be concerned with.
One last question about your parents. As you explained, they ran a bookstore, and there was a gay porn section in the bookstore. You use a lot of sexual language and sexual description in your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you think your parents would be shocked or offended by the language that you use.
Well, you know what they do is whenever they see it, they do see it eventually, you know, after a while, like on video or on a record or something. And then that's when they use their selective understanding of English. I don't know what this mean, but everybody thinks that's so funny. So that's what my mother would say. Why is that funny? That's not that funny. She doesn't know what it means, but she does, which is ultimately the greatest joke of all.
Well, Margaret Cho, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Margaret Cho recorded last year. There's a new film version of her one-woman show, I'm the One That I Want. Tomorrow, she'll be the Grand Marshal of the Gay Pride Parade in San Diego. Coming up, a review of the new film, What Lies Beneath. This is Fresh Air. The new supernatural thriller, What Lies Beneath, stars Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer as Norman and Claire Spencer. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, whose films include Contact, Death Becomes Her, Forrest Gump, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and Back to the Future. Henry Sheehan has a review.
Poor Claire Spencer. Everyone thinks she's going crazy. The wife of Norman Spencer, an academic scientist, Claire is a former musician who now spends most of her time sprucing up the fabulous lakeside home she and her husband inherited from his father. But renovation is not an innocent pastime. Disturbing sounds come from the noisy neighbors next door. Worse, there's trouble in the bathroom, and not just to do with old pipes. Claire keeps seeing things, including ghostly messages written on the steam-drenched mirror in which she usually examines her blemish-free face. Soon, Claire believes that the ghost of a dead girl is haunting the place and might even want Claire's body and her husband for herself. This is the setup for What Lies Beneath, a disappointing suspense thriller that is nearly as lumpish and vague as its title. I'm not going to give any more of the plot away. The advertising makes it clear enough that this is Fatal Attraction with ghosts. Let's leave it at that. The movie's real shock is that it's the work of Robert Zemeckis, one of Hollywood's most intelligent entertainers. To be sure, Zemeckis' visual ingenuity doesn't fail him here. Elegantly shot, What Lies Beneath draws on the established lexicon of suspense filmmaking. Zemeckis uses ominous tracking shots to force us, however reluctantly, to accompany our heroine on dangerous reconnaissance missions to the neighbor's house. He milks windows, door frames, mirrors, and reflective surfaces for all the voyeuristic zing they can produce. Plus, he adds to that lexicon with some ingenious variations of his own, revealing shock elements within the frame by moving decor within it or moving the camera around that decor. But it isn't scary, and it's easy to tell why from this scene. Claire, possessed by the mysterious ghost, is doing the old Eve thing, force-feeding Norman an apple.
Hello, Dr. Spencer.
Mrs. Spencer.
Forbidden fruit. You got a problem with that?
You can learn a lot from that one dumb-sounding clip. Alan Silvestri's music, for example, flagrantly imitates the scores Bernard Herrmann did for Alfred Hitchcock. That is actually appropriate for a film that makes reference to Psycho, Rear Window, Suspicion, Shadow of a Doubt, and Spellbound. Just as flagrant and far more damaging are the terrifyingly terrible performances from Michelle Pfeiffer as Claire and Harrison Ford as Norman. As you can tell from the clip, when Pfeiffer is playing Claire possessed, it sounds as if she's channeling Anne Margaret from back in her sex kitten days. Of course, subtlety is not exactly coin of the realm in a scene where, in order to show her newly inflamed libido, Claire puts on a red dress and sprawls on the polished hardwood floors with a lit candle between her legs. What do you suppose she's after, aside from a sore back and singed thighs? Harrison Ford, who plays Norman, seems to have taken the role on a bet. Can he play an entire movie without ever modulating the tone of his voice or changing the expression on his face? The answer is yes and no. Ford certainly gets into that freeze-frame facial state we immediately recognize from all his, quote, serious, unquote, roles. And his voice does take on the burbling quality of a sludge-infested industrial waterway. But he can't be said to be really playing the character. It's more like a personal appearance. If Ford had spoken at a normal clip, he could easily have sliced 30 minutes off the movie's two-hour-plus running time. These are not minor shortcomings. What lies beneath is a movie about ghostly possession and deep secrets, so its suspense is tightly bound to the character's sense of self. Who cares if Claire's body is taken over by an avenging spirit if she didn't have a personality in the first place? And who cares if Norman might have had a naughty fling in the past, if he's just a big snore? Zemeckis has built a beautiful structure for what lies beneath. He should have been more careful who he let move into it.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week was Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated, Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Turn of the Century, a novel by Kurt Anderson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Monday encore presentations of our series on American popular song with a tribute to U.B. Blake, composer of I'm Just Wild About Harry, Memories of You, and Charleston Rag. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.